mostly last night and this morning because I got it yesterday, but I love it. And I will need more time with it. So we're doing an issue on essentially the meaning of ecology. The idea being that the premise of the issue is that the standard definitions of ecology, the standard ways that we understand it, appear to be not enough. They don't take enough into account. And certainly your work is one of the ones that I see as really trying to help us understand the true vastness of ecology. And what I've been reading in your book has not been disappointing in that regard. But I thought we could start if you would just give us the elevator pitch, brief and obviously woefully inadequate, but a starting place definition of what an ecology is.
I love that. And I share your concern that the understandings of ecology are largely inadequate because they suffer from another sort of ecological problem, which is an ecological problem of our perception and those aspects of perception that are trained to be refined and receiving of particular kinds of information and patterns. And so it's the nature of nature that when there is a way that there has been an ecological learning. Okay, so the way that lots of different aspects of organisms are changing each other as they learn to be together, which is an ongoing thing. It's not something they learn and then it's learned. It's an ongoing, ever-shifting thing. But it's entirely possible to be in several hundred years, it's thousands of years, starting with, I mean, arguably with aqueducts and agriculture, into industrialism, into the factory, into now the digital era, where there is a habituated perception of how causality functions. And that causality is a learning. And we're learning to work with that form of causality. How do how do you get the thing to put in your mouth when you're a baby to alleviate the chewing need? How do you get love? How do you get through school? How do you become a respected member of your community? How do you get a partner? How do you raise your kids? How do you pay your taxes? How do you like all this stuff is actually quite intimate. But that habituated perception can pers then look at ecology, perceive ecology through the same habits. And so I think if we're going to talk about what is ecology, I think the first thing is to say, for myself, I know that it's true that I am born into, bred into a world of various kinds of efficiencies, optimizations, categories, ways in which things have been separated so that they can be operationalized, instrumentalized, and that because of that, I have to be very, very careful about believing what I am perceiving in the natural world. So this is a tricky thing. Because then when you want to say, well, what is it? The first thing you're going to run into is a problem of language. The second thing you're going to run into is a problem of metaphors. and the way those metaphors sneak into and carry the baggage of a lot of other metaphors that are linked in to the industrial metaphor. If you look at the way a factory is organized, you have lots of different parts that are producing, they're all doing the thing they do, and they produce something. They're purposive. There is a production line. And if you take that version of what is real and productive and purposive, and you look at a forest, the unfortunate thing is that you can find that purposiveness there. You can itemize out the organisms of a forest. You can assign purposive ecological duties to them, right? So the soil is making it possible for the tree to grow, which makes it possible for there to be oxygen, which makes it possible, and you get into a mechanistic causality. It's very, very easy to slide down that sort of rabbit hole of existing confusions. So what is ecology? And how do we describe it? And how do we hold, in some way, a hold on an edge, hold in a stretch, those habits that are itching to come through? So that we might be able to recognize the inconvenience of the way life moves. So I think for one of the biggest pieces for me around the perception of and the description of ecology is the problem is that it's a noun. That's problem number one. This thing is moving. It's responding, it's shaping, it's calibrating, it's reshaping, it's learning, it's moving, it's morphing and remorphing, so that every organism in a forest, every organism in a tide pool, every organism in your body, which is most of your body, are all responding all the time to the other organisms. Which means they're changing. If you think about how Jeff is when Jeff is with one friend, and how Jeff is when Jeff is with another friend, and how Jeff is when Jeff was 5, and how Jeff is when Jeff is going to be 85, and how Jeff is with this person that you have a, sexy relationship with, and how Jeff is with this person that you have a kind of a more, I don't know, a more practical relationship with, that you make stuff with. Those are all different aspects of you that are there all the time. And just like in an ecology, different organisms bring out different types of possibility of communication, of something beyond the Shannon notions of communication, which are like signal and response. But something else, something I would refer to as communing, something that's a mutual communion. But there's another noun, so better to keep it in communing. That in our communing, we are shaping. What's happening right now? I am taking in the various gestures of your eyes, your breath, your movements, and I'm thinking, moving. Sometimes not thinking, responding to how I can be when I'm with you right now. We live in a world in which everyone's asking, who are you? How do you make yourself better? How can I be a better person? All right, that's a really non-ecological question. Who can I be when I'm with you? Who can I be in this circumstance? Who can I be in this other context? What can I learn about being in responsiveness and in communion with other organisms in different contexts? I'm putting it in that framework right away because the intimacy of the perception of ecology is the most important part. If it stays as some scientific abstract, an academic definition, the grokking, the holding in your body of that ecological movement doesn't happen. You can learn a lot of vocabulary, but still be a jerk because you're trampling all over these very delicate, moving interdependencies that are all around you all the time. You're never not in all these ecologies.
Right.
So there's ecologies of ideas, there's a family is an ecology, your body's an ecology, a forest is an ecology. And the way in which the kind of Webster definition talks about ecology is that it's a pattern of patterns that are interdependent, roughly. And what's wrong with that definition is that then you go looking for patterns. And we have lived in a world of, sort of savvy systems speak for a while where people were cool when they were pattern hunters, right?
Right.
That was like the groovy thing to be. But the problem with patterns is that that is a static rhythm. And the rhythms and the resonances of ecological relationships are not static. The rhythm of Jeff changes depending on who you're with, what you ate, how you slept. I mean, 1,000 dependencies is in the rhythm of Jeff.
I believe that in many ways, that's because I'm fascinated by your ongoing evolution of thinking, and you wrote about Symathesis some time ago, and that's kind of what you're describing now is this ongoing, utterly mutually responsive, co-learning event that is life, that you can't see yourself as separate from it. It doesn't exist independent of you somewhere else. It's just the way life unfolds. And I loved that. And then you spoke about warm data. You started working with warm data, which was a way of essentially seeing the reality of Symathesis, changing how we see so that we can see the interconnectedness, not as an idea of interconnectedness, but as an actuality of our lived experience, right? Which I see that's what makes it warm versus cold. It's something that's alive in you in this moment, alive in other people. Yeah, and now you've added a term which I hope I can. Aphanopoiesis is the third term.
Aphanopoiesis. Yes, it's super exciting. Aphanopoiesis is super exciting.
I have found this to be the most exciting of the three so far, but maybe the fourth will be more exciting. I don't know how this works, but it's so you've given us a little bit of a some thoughts about ecology and the difficulty with the idea of ecology. With aphanopoiesis, what you're saying is you're looking at what makes change possible. Because what you're saying is in ecologies, there's a tendency for things to just keep repeating. You talked a lot about tautology in your book, and your father Gregory talked about that a lot, which is things keep repeating. Oh my God, you had this amazing thing in the book about how the idea of eugenics is baked into our thinking, and even though we all would detest the word, it's still part of our thinking. I don't know. Like, can we take a diversion so you can say a little bit about that? Because I found that sort of shocking and fascinating and unfortunately true.
Yeah, it's really important, this piece, especially right now, because the idea of eugenics, and I'm speaking to this through all sorts of lenses simultaneously, but one is that my grandfather was actually there. He coined the term genetics, and it was his colleagues that were coining eugenics. And this is, I think, an important piece because it's the difference between a mechanism and an ecology. Right? In an ecology, you have genetics, and that means that that's a study of how organisms change. In a mechanism, you have eugenics, which is a study of how you can make it change. Right? And that's a very different thing. And in one case, there is a kind of respect and awe, and I mean, almost a mysticism, but a mysticism with a lot of scientific rigor for the way that organisms are changing each other. If you look at an ecological evolutionary process and you say, how does an organism know how to evolve? Where did that information come from? That what you're going to come to pretty quickly is that organism has been in communication with a lot of other organisms, receiving communications it may not have had any place to even register or respond or put into its familiar kind of cognitive process. But still, it was learning. Whereas, if you have, a domesticated organism that hasn't been allowed for several generations, like chickens or all sorts of domesticated organisms, they cannot evolve because they don't have the information from all the other organisms. They don't have the caches of unseen communication. All right, one is a mechanized version, one is an ecological version. And so this thread of eugenics is part and parcel of the industrial mindset of modernity. It's there with the what is the change you want to make? How are you going to make it mindset, right? Which is, we hear this all the time. Set goals for yourself and then make them happen. All right.
Absolutely. Yes,
There it
definitely.
is. Every Fitbit, every SAT test, every the way we're looking at health right now, the way we look at economics, the word economics was produced out of eugenics. Every single statistician, every mathematician that created was part of the beginning of statistics was a eugenicist. So this thing is so baked in. And later on, there's this calling out of eugenics as a way of controlling breeding, and Hitler got a hold of it, and then we got rid of Hitler and we got rid of eugenics. Wrong. We did not get rid of eugenics, and it never was only about breeding. It was about optimizing the human being.
Right.
Okay, now this is where it dipped into all kinds of spirituality. It dipped into, I mean, the sticky muck of this epistemology is everywhere, and it's really hard to find your way through it. I mean, a lot of people are stuck in it in their yoga, right? It's like it's not actually something that's easy to get. You want your kid to have a high IQ. The IQ test came out of eugenics.
I think this is what I was getting from your reading too. It's all predicated on assumption that some form of being human is more valuable than other forms of being human. And then that is just an infection through our whole thought process.
The question is whose version of better? And what is the epistemology that's feeding that notion of better? So, is it better to be super fit and rich? Well, no. In some contexts, it might be, but if you happen to be, living in the middle of the Amazon or in the desert, you need to be able to be in relationship with the people around you and to read the signs of where the water and the danger and where the animals are. And that's much more important than being
Yes,
fit and rich. So
absolutely.
that rubric doesn't work there. So whose rubric is it?
Yes, I know you're running out of time. Do you have time for one last question?
Sure. One last one, and then we'll come back to this and do part two.
We'll come back, but this will kind of create at least a loop here because
Okay.
the term phanopoiesis is wonderful because what you're saying, the question you asked before, which is how do we know how to evolve? How do we know how to change? How does change happen? And your realization that something happens that creates the possibility of change. You mentioned Charles Sanders Peirce in your one of the chapters in your book. Peirce was had this idea of firstness. There's a possibility of change that needs to exist before the change can actually emerge. What we see as change is not the first step in the process of change. That unseen conditions are coalescing to create the possibility for a change. And what you're saying is, that's what anapoiesis is. Anapoiesis is that unseen coalescence of factors that create the possibility for an emergence. And it seems to me what you're suggesting in the book and probably working on is how do we work with this? How do we, because you're saying it's unseen, not hidden. It's unseen, meaning it's outside of our current perceptual habits. But it's how do we see it? How do we start to work with this vast unseen factors and their coalescence that creates the possibility for change? Because if we aren't doing that, then we aren't really able to participate in the activity of change. Anyway, that's how I understand it. And I just thought it was a magnificent term, and I wanted to give you a chance to speak about it a little bit.
So the Greek prefix aphani means unseen, but like you said, it doesn't mean hidden. It doesn't mean invisible. It means unseen. So in the pandemic, the Greek caregivers in the hospital, the nurses, well, they were the aphani caregivers. They were unseen. Aphani is a kind of shyness. It's a sort of just out of reachness. So we see that in the word diaphanous. We see it in phantom or fantasy. And then poiesis is to become, to be, to. So and we see that in poetry or in a lot of people are familiar with autopoiesis, which is an organism's self-reproductive process. So the question is, we're really deep in the woods in several insidious processes. And insidiousness, this was kind of how it all started. Is looking at how do things become insidious? What does that mean? And we have things that are insidious: greed, corruption, misogyny, racism, addiction, etc. The need for control is an insidious problem. And what we mean when we say that is that it's somewhere deep down and you can't quite get to it. And in the etymology of it, you can find that it means something that has been gradually over time accumulating in a way that no one was paying attention to, that later emerged as a harmful problem. And then what we try to do is talk about the emergence of the harmful situation and to fix it there. But by then, all those processes that have been coalescing and gradually shaping each other have been cooking for a long time. So by the time we get to emergence, it's late. We're late. We're too late. Right? So what we're talking about is pre-emergence, before it emerges. What's going downstairs in the dark and making it possible for things to take place in other ways? And so for me, that has been a huge part of warm data. Because for many years I could never describe to people like what's happening here and why is it important and why don't you try to get a deliverable and why don't you try to make people say what they learned and what it was all about? And I've always been like, no, because that's sacred territory. That's not for me to say. The way that things are combining and shifting and moving for them, they don't know. I don't want them to know. What I want to have happen is to create a scenario, a space where things can combine and coalesce in ways they haven't before, and to offer enough possibilities that you actually generate an ecological combining, an ecological coalescence of stories, of overlaps, of underswirls, of steepings around, of interweavings, of ideas, of memories, of thoughts, of words, of non-words, like a dream. And that you should not have language for that. You don't have language. There's no way to say, I learned this thing from the Warm Data Lab. And if you say that, I know that it's super sweet that you're trying to say it, and I love that. But at the same time, don't get attached to those words because they get in the way of the learning, which is much more profound and much more multiplicitous. If insidiousness is a gradual combining toward harm, what is it to produce the conditions for a gradual combining of multiple processes toward life, toward vitality, toward healing? Because surely they are made in the same way. What we're talking about is the deep stuff. And you can go to a course and you can learn to speak new language. And you can say that now that I can speak in this new way, I'm no longer a racist. But actually, you still are. You just have a different vocabulary. And so, you can do the same thing. You can make laws for corruption and you can make everybody abide by the laws. And they can all abide by the laws, but the corruption's still there. So, you can't fix these things in the seen world. They're not fixable there. So, with any kind of depth, you can get people to change their language and you can put in new laws, but it doesn't change the culture. All right. We're always watching it out how culture, which you can think about as language and education and various institutional processes and this and that. But you can also remember that yogurt is a culture. Fermentation is a culture. So what's happening in a culture is that there are organisms that are changing over time with time. Okay, whenever you talk about culture, time is an implicit part of that. What kind of culturing, what's in the rhythming, what's in the resonances that will produce, not to say you should do this or you should do that or you should think like this or you should meditate like that, but what is the way to produce this possible, cauldron of conditionings from which the behavior that is going to be generative of life is intrinsic. It's not instructed. And so that's the big piece, is that an ecological change is intrinsically moving
Yes.
toward another thing, not instructionally.
I love that. And I definitely feel like we need to talk again because I feel like there's a whole practice of this that I'm sure you're working on, that there's a whole different way of engaging with with possibility that I'm sure we could
Go on and on.
go on and on about as we always do. So oh, I'm very excited about that term. So
Super
we'll,
exciting. And it took
it
me
is.
years, Jeff. It took years before I was willing to actually say, no, the thing is that the thing is unseen. It must be unseen. That's what we have to talk about next time, is why it's important. So that the idea is, well, if it's unseen, then let's just put some light on it and find it. But no, because if you do that, It comes into the perception of the familiar, and it gets
Yes.
transmitted. It gets
Always.
metabolized always back in. So, McKinsey started learning about complexity and systems theory, and they turned it into a way to make business because that's what they do.
Right. Well, there's so many parallels to spiritual practice that I see in this, because in the same way, spiritual practice happens in the invisible, but we always want to make a technique out of it or understand it, and then the magic is gone. So we'll talk about the magic the next time we have a chance, and hopefully we'll catch up. Much love to you, Nora. I'm so happy to
And to
talk
you,
to
Jeff.
you.
Always
All
great to
right.
talk to you.
We'll
All right.
do it again.